Love a man, oh, where can you be? The night is cold and I'm so all alone. I'd give my soul just to call you now. Got a moon above me.
Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The author of Labor of Love is with us this hour. Maura Weigel, The Invention of Dating. And Maura has looked at dating in the United States from the time there first was dating in the United States, 1900. Young women started coming from farms and small towns to big cities in the late 1800s, and it changed the way they were meeting young men and the way young men were meeting young women. The book looks at so many aspects of love. It goes all the way up to 2016 and this online phenomena. It looks at those who have had to look for love in ways that may have been secret because of the way they were sexually identified. And we're going to find out about the money that's involved in dating, how you have to look really good. We'll talk about shop girls and how they had to learn to flirt, what flirting means, and how dating has been associated with work for the whole time that we've been dating. How people who were in the working class dated, how middle class people dated, sugar daddies and sugar babies, and the list goes on. It's a fascinating book, and Maura is our guest. She is a writer, a translator, and a scholar, currently finishing a PhD at Yale University. She's written for The Guardian, The New Republic, among many other publications. She was born in Brooklyn and has lived in many different places, Berlin and Beijing, and Labor of Love happens to be her first book. Her PhD is in comparative literature, and she also got married, actually, while she was writing this book. So we will explore that story and her courtship, but we'll wait till the end of the hour. We're going to welcome phone calls for Maura. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Maura, thank you so much for being with us. Hi.
Thank you for having me. Hi.
Hi. What a terrific thing to write about, isn't it? I don't recall ever having read anything about the history of dating, and I learned so much from your book.
I'm so glad. Yeah, it was fun to write about.
I would imagine. So we started dating. We first heard the word date around 1900?
Yeah, that's right. It's around 1900 that you first start seeing people use this expression to make a date or to have a date. And it has everything to do, like you were saying in the introduction, with women entering the workforce. It's sort of a time in American history when young people are pouring into cities, and it's actually a period of economic depression that sends a lot of women whose families wouldn't have had them work earlier into the workforce, and both of those play a huge role. But it's right around the turn of the last century that it gets started.
And there used to be things that were date books. What were those?
Well, you know, it's kind of the way we'd have a calendar or something. Now, there are different versions of it in different regions and for different people, but the expression really comes from the idea that you would pencil in your date book when you're going to meet someone. So it's like, you know, a calendar or a schedule.
Mm-hmm. Before 1900, we were very, I don't know, kind of stuffy about the way we would date. People would come calling, and I guess you're right, for the middle class, people would still come calling. It was the working class that was going to dating in different ways.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Oh, what's really distinctive about dating, when you think about it, and it's weird for Americans in 2016 to think about it this way, but it's really not this idea that you would meet someone at school or at work or out in public and then get together with them, that it would be a stranger who you'd choose and spend time with, and then if you like them, go further. That's a totally novel courtship system. Like, almost no society, I think I will say no other society in human history before about 1900 had a system like that. It was always controlled by parents or by priests or rabbis or community members. And the invention of dating is this exciting and, I think, for many people also frightening moment when the working classes, who, as you're saying, are the first, it's working class women who first have the freedom and the obligation to go out and have jobs where they meet men as opposed to just being in the parlor. they really invent it around that time, and it changes everything about courtship in the modern world.
When you said that, I just almost, it made me stop. You're going out with a total stranger. You're going out with a total stranger to figure out if you're going to spend time with this person, if you might fall in love. You have to talk. You got to dress up. You got to spend money on the whole event. It is kind of strange when you think about it.
It's totally weird. I mean, if you think about it, I remember I had a friend in grad school who was from India, and she actually almost had a marriage arranged by her parents, although in most respects, you know, she's a quote-unquote modern person. She works as an investment banker. She lives in London now. But I remember her mother saying to me, look, this idea that the fact that you liked how someone looked in a bar would be a better predictor
right.
of your compatibility than having your entire family try to think about someone with a similar background and similar values. That's crazy. And I had to give it to her. I mean, I think it is a little crazy.
It is a little crazy.
When you compare it to most other times and places.
There are some wonderful stories in the book, and I wanted you to tell them during the course of the hour. Tell us the story of the woman who met Irving Berlin in a bar.
Oh, God,
it's
I
a
love
great
this
story.
So Ellen MacKay was a socialite in New York in the 1920s, and this is the era of prohibition, so you're not allowed to drink alcohol. In theory, in practice, all sorts of people do go to these speakeasies to drink, and it becomes a sort of fashionable thing for upper-class people, society people to do. And Ellen MacKay, who is an heir to this tremendous fortune, I forget the figures, but I think it was her grandfather, was one of the men who'd sort of owned the Comstock load out west. She was an heiress to like hundreds of millions of dollars in 1920s dollars, some obscene amount, was really tired of all the men her mother was trying to set her up with at these proper society balls and sort of debutante events. And she would get her father's driver to sneak her downtown to the speakeasy after those parties ended. And there's a wonderful story, one of my favorite discoveries that I tell in the book, about her and her friend sneaking off to the speakeasy and sort of making eyes at a man who was sitting at the bar. And, you know, a speakeasy was a really rambunctious environment. You'd have queer people and straight people and people of different races in some cases all mixing in this illegal space where they weren't policed in the same way they'd usually be because the whole thing was illegal to be in a bar. And Ellen MacKay, this very fancy but very bold young woman, sees a man sitting alone at the bar, and her friend whispers to Ellen what the bartender had just whispered to her, which was, that man sitting over there is Irving Berlin. And Irving Berlin was, you know, he was becoming famous then, but he was a Jewish immigrant, you know, who started his career singing songs in Chinese restaurants downtown for tips. He was not someone who, a socialite, multimillionaire like Ellen MacKay would ever have met at one of those boring debutante events.
Right.
But she goes over and introduces herself to him. He buys her a drink, and they fall in love. They have this splendid love affair. Her parents were horrified, and they ended up being trailed by the paparazzi so much that they actually took the 6 train in New York downtown to City Hall to get married because the paparazzi followed their car. And they got married, I want to say, in 1926, 1927, something like that. And they stayed happily married until, I think, she passed away first, but for their entire lives. So it's really one of these utterly romantic stories that comes out of the history of dating that just never would have happened when you think of, like, the Jane Austen scenario or the Downton Abbey scenario. Even a few years earlier, a woman of her class would never have gotten to meet someone from such a different background.
Yeah, it is a great story. Let's talk about, because there have been movies made of these young women, and you write about them, women who went into working in department stores.
And
evidently they were told, I was really fascinated by some of the books that were written and lectures given of what those young women should do to, A, learn how to flirt, and I wonder how people learn how to flirt and what flirting is, and B, the advice they were given about who they should model their flirting and their bodies after.
Yeah, well, I got really interested, you know, just to back out, the whole concept of the book was like I wanted to take all these ideas that we now take for granted about courtship and try to figure out where they came from. You know, it came from a place of feeling pretty confused myself. I thought, you know, where does this idea even come from that we take for granted? And so the chapter that you're talking about, Kathleen, is called Likes. And I wanted to investigate this idea that I think we now all assume in dating apps and our dating lives that someone who likes things that are like what we like would be a good romantic partner. So, for instance, you know, on OkCupid or Match.com, we list what books we like or what bands we like, and we think that that's a good predictor of who we would get along with. Really weird idea, if you think about it, in the long scope of human history. But so anyway, to get back to the shop girls, what I discovered is some of the first women who dated, and some of the first women who talked about taste this way, and they were women who went to work in department stores in the 1910s and 1920s, who, as we were talking about before, were working class, but had access to this much fancier world and an opportunity to meet all kinds of fancy people. Think about what a big deal it is in a Jane Austen novel when, like, one new guy moves to your town.
Yes, right.
And then think how exciting it would be to work at a counter where you might meet hundreds of rich men every day. And these women were given, you know, we saw that movie Brooklyn, if people saw that, came out recently.
Yes, I love that.
There's a girl character. Yeah, it's really sweet. But these women were given, you know, as we see in that movie or in older movies like The Women with Joan Crawford or, you know, the movie It with Clara Bow, these women were often given very direct instructions in how they were supposed to dress and how they were supposed to behave. And these also happened to be the ways they would act to try to attract men of a higher class. And, you know, this involved dressing the right way, even moving your hands the right way, speaking in the right tone of voice. And it was fascinating to me to learn that these sort of flirting skills or skills for presenting yourself in an appealing way served women very well, both on the dating market, you know, trying to meet men who would come in to buy fancy things, but also in the workplace. And often you see, I think in the book I talk about the owner of Lord and Taylor talking about how he wants his young women to learn how to conduct themselves in a certain way in the store. So it's this funny thing, taste, where it influences how people date. It also influences career prospects. And I think we still see that in a lot of ways. I mean, you have to present yourself in a certain way to be appealing either on the job market or the dating market.
So you're selling, in essence, and then the commercial market gets hold of this, you're selling a kind of sex appeal right away, right?
Definitely. And it sort of goes both ways, right? It's like you're sexier if you're dressed the right way and act the right way. And your sexiness or how well you flirt also helps sell whatever you're selling. You know, we now take it totally for granted that, you know, you'd use a sexy model to sell, like, Perrier sparkling water. But there's no connection between sex and Perrier sparkling water.
Right.
It's really a very weird assumption when you think about it. And I think it's really these shop girls or these pioneer women in the workforce who help invent that idea and make it successful, for better and worse.
Mm-hmm. You also write very interesting chapters about people who are inverts. I guess I hadn't heard that phrase very much.
Yeah.
And how they had to go looking for love. But I was surprised how many gay bars there were in the 30s and 40s and drag queen culture that was thriving, really.
Yeah, it was hugely popular. So I think the term used, invert, was like a medical term that doctors used in the 19th century, or people would talk about men with, quote, female spirits trapped in their bodies. And this was really, you know, what we'd now call gay or queer, LGBT, basically. And you have this huge culture of gay bars or sort of queer spaces in New York, even from, actually, interesting thing is they kind of predate the invention of dating. If we read, you know, Walt Whitman now, we know the poet Walt Whitman, mm-hmm. We know that in the 1870s and 1880s there were plenty of good spots to be a man looking for men in New York. But they are these really fun sort of countercultural spaces, and in the 1920s and 1930s, they're hugely popular. There's, I think you were alluding to, there was this famous drag ball in Harlem that took place in the 1930s that was called Faggot's Ball, and men would go dressed in women's clothing in different ways and perform and dance, and the most famous families in New York would go and watch, and some rumors said, you know, certain members of those families would partake in the party, but the Vanderbilts and the Astors always went to Faggot's Ball in the 1930s, and it was reported on in the society papers. So I think, you know, I mean, actually it's a really kind of sad thing to think about this week
yes.
In light of the horrible, horrible events in Orlando. But those countercultural spaces have a really long and vivid history and played a huge role in how everyone goes out and dates. In that Ellen McKay Irving Berlin story about them meeting in the speakeasy, there certainly would have been queer couples in that environment,
right.
too.
So how do you identify, be you gay or straight, over the years, how did people identify whether the person that they might be interested in was available?
Well, you know, there were these really elaborate codes for doing that. And, you know, now, hopefully, although, again, you know, Orlando shows us not completely, many people in many cities can take for granted that if you're a man interested in men or a woman interested in women and you go and you make a mistake about who might be interested in you, if you flirt with the wrong person, you won't get beaten up or arrested, both of which were very real possibilities for much, if not most, of the 20th century. So these different subcultures would develop very elaborate codes for sort of advertising what you wanted to other people without giving yourself away to someone who might rat you out to the police or harass you. Often this had to do with articles of clothing. So the red tie, a red tie in New York around 1900 was a signal that men seeking men used to identify one another. There was a book I read and talk about in the book called... I think it's called The Homosexual in America, A Subjective Approach, that was ghostwritten under a fake name by this sociologist and criminologist, Edward Sagarin. He publishes under the name Daniel Corey Webster. But it was full of descriptions of how gay men, you know, what we would now call gay men, they still called them, I guess in that period they said homosexuals, but they would advertise themselves to each other with a certain kind of gesture, a certain kind of code word. And this now, you know, it's a kind of theater. In the same way that the drag ball is a theater, there's some theater involved. But it also was really imperative to stay safe in an environment that was often hostile.
Yes. And what about be you gay or straight? How you would determine, obviously there was no gay marriage back then, so married was not an operative word. But how would you determine if somebody was available to you? If you were that shop girl, you know, working in Macy's or someplace, and there was somebody you were flirting with, how would you make sure that that person wasn't already engaged to or married to somebody else?
Well, I think there were probably a lot of the same anxieties around that subject that we still have.
Seven now, yes.
I don't know. I think I'm trying to think if there are any concrete examples of ways you'd make it clear. I mean, in certain eras, like in the 50s, teens would do things like wear pre-engagement rings or...
Going steady.
Yeah, for it to show they were going steady. You'd see all these wonderful variations. There was an older woman I interviewed from Minnesota who was, it was actually very funny, she was my grandfather's hospice caretaker. He passed away toward the end of when I was writing the book, which was sad, but at the very end of my time, I sort of spent a week or so in this house with like several generations of people who were then reminiscing about their own memories. But it was funny because my grandfather was from Minneapolis, and then this woman was from a town up north in Minnesota, and they had had similar ages. I guess he was older than she is, but then my aunts were there who were her age, and everyone had, like, different memories of what the signs were. Like, my aunts from Minneapolis were saying, oh, well, you would wear a ring, or maybe you'd wear this jacket. And the woman from near Duluth was saying, oh, no, we would wear a scarf, and you had to tie the scarf a certain way to show that you had a boyfriend and you were taken. So I think there are all kinds of variations that you see across different communities. And now, of course, in an age of social media, there are like online ways to signify this kind of thing.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. We're speaking this hour with the author of a really fascinating book that's the invention and the history of dating in this country, Maura Weigel. The book is Labor of Love. This is her first book. She's done writing for a number of publications. She is completing a PhD in comparative literature at Yale right now, and she happened to get married. We'll have to hear her story. She won't mind telling us, I'm sure, as the hour goes on. But I'm sure that you have stories, too, and you're all listening from different generations. So there are certain memories you have of the dating practices that your parents or grandparents would tell you about, the association between a lot of work that's involved in dating. You know, you got to make sure you look good and your hair is good and you get kind of dressed up. And if you're dating a lot, then you got to keep doing that over and over again. Again, for these sharp girls, as Maura tells us in the book, they had to make sure they were looking spiffy every single day. And the way people date changing with the economy, she says you could even say dating is the form that courtship takes in a society where it takes place in a free market. Here's our phone number. Join us if you would like. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. She writes about lots of different histories, certainly. World War II. She writes about the sexual revolution in the 1960s. She writes about the AIDS crisis in the 80s in this country and the hookup culture of now. So feel free to delve into any of those as we carry along this hour here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The author of Labor of Love, Maura Weigel, is our guest, The Invention of Dating, and she writes about the history of dating in this country going back to 1900. We're welcoming phone calls. I'm interested in particularly hearing from those of you who are part of the computer. I know all the young males in our family have used online sites, which is not a part of my generation, and some of you may have been part of a generation where you had actual courting. People would come to the house and make calls, and everybody in the family would sit around and listen to the conversation that was taking place between those who are being courted and those who are courting. We welcome your phone calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. I didn't know very much about this whole sugar daddy, sugar baby thing that, and you write about this, and how many college girls have signed up to these sites, more. That was fascinating to me.
Yeah, so I did, you know, I think probably maybe some listeners have heard of this, but I think that there have been a number of different websites and apps that have developed to sort of facilitate something that either is prostitution or sex work or looks a lot like it. And, you know, this has always been an aspect of dating. It's always existed at the edges of dating. And I think it's part of all dating, actually, this ambiguity about, you know, what is the person really in it for? Is he in it for the nice dinner? Is she in it for the sex? You know, there are always these ambiguities. But one of the more shocking or sort of brazen instances of this kind of app is this website, or it's an app website company called, it's called Seeking Arrangement, that connects usually young women who want money with usually older men who are looking for young women to be their companions in different ways. I guess there are also some young men on the site. The sugar babies I interviewed said they'd never encountered an older woman as a in the daddy role, as the phrase sugar daddy suggests. It's a gendered role. But yeah, the way these sites work is you sign up, and they really just act like a social media platform to connect people in those two positions. And I guess it's probably a bit shocking. I'm so used to it now, having talked to so many different people. But it basically functions sort of like an escort platform that connects people, and the money or goods that change hands happen off the platform. So it's not technically, you know, a sex work company. But it's hard to know exactly how reliable the numbers are. But it's a large operation, and it's very explicitly, as you said, geared towards people in college and women with student debt.
So there are a lot of young college women, mostly, who have signed up for this.
That's what they say, and it seems, you know, I actually don't have the exact figures present to mind, but it's definitely in the tens or hundreds of thousands. They did, the company underwent a concerted pitch to sort of recruit college students. They have sort of a freemium model where you can sign up for the site for free, but then if you pay, I think it's $20, $25, or $30 a month, you can become sort of a premium member who turns up more often in other people's search results. But if you registered using a .edu address proving that you were still a student, they would waive that fee, I believe. And they do recruiting events at colleges. They accompany publishes every year.
Really?
A list of what they call sugar baby universities, so universities that have the most women using the site, NYU, Columbia, I think also, I want to say, gosh, their university in Texas. I don't want to malign a university without right. being sure which one, but they're often near the top. I think UCLA is also pretty high. Or maybe, no, sorry, it's USC that's high.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, these are good schools that everyone's heard of. Mm. And, yeah, it's more common than you might think.
Let's go to some phone calls. Rebecca in Madison is our first caller, Maura. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, I'm calling to ask about the advent or evolution of dating for older women.
Yeah.
Because I am in my late 50s. My husband had passed away a little over 6 years ago, and I've told many friends, I'm not dating anymore. I'm out of it. I don't want to. It's too much energy, and people are surprised. And I'm thinking, why are you so surprised that I don't want to date? And why are there expectations for older women to date now?
Well, it's really interesting, and there's so much from the book. I hope you'll maybe read the book, because I say a ton about this. But I think it's actually very common, the response that you bring up. I've heard this from a lot of women who either have been divorced or had spouses pass away, that they say, you know, to be honest, I'm not really interested in spending this much of my time this way, and I applaud you in that decision. I think that's fine. There's so much. I mean, I think the reality, not to be cynical, is that there's so much money to be made by different businesses sort of pressuring women of all ages to feel they always should be actively seeking men or seeking to be attractive to men, you know, whether it's your gym or the makeup company or the restaurant where you'll go out to dinner. And I think that actually it is everyone's prerogative not, you know, sort of lean out of dating, like not work so hard at dating all the time. I think that by the same token, I would say if it is something that you're interested in, or folks who've had the long relationships and are interested in, I do think that it's one of the areas where the advent of apps and online dating have helped the most, just creating new ways to meet someone when you're not necessarily at school or in that phase of life at work where you meet a ton of people that way. So I do think that sites like Match.com and OkCupid can be a huge boon to people in your position. But I think it's absolutely your right not to do any of it, you know, to resist that pressure to work at dating that we're all given.
Yeah, it's just sucks too much energy, I think, that I could put elsewhere.
Well, dating is work. That's, you know, a constant theme of my book and of the history.
Sure is.
That dating really is work in a lot of different ways. And, you know, it's work that we should all be free to do on our own terms, depending on what we want from it. So,
right. Okay,
I think
thank
you're
you.
Makes sense.
Thanks, Rebecca. Thanks very much for the call. Well, let's move into this, because it is a whole new way of meeting each other. There are so many websites. You can let us know how many there are and how specific they are. But I look at the young people in my family and their friends, that's how they're meeting each other now.
Definitely. More than, I think, the most recent statistics I've read, it's around 35% of people married in the United States every
Ooh.
Year started online, the couple relationships started online. So it's a very common, very, very common phenomenon.
And what do you think of this, having to pick your favorite band or your favorite book, or how do you get a profile that makes you understand fairly well the person you're about to go out with?
Well, I think it's funny because, you know, each of these sites has a different kind of set of idiosyncrasies. I always like, you know, because I am a historian, I always like to emphasize that even though a lot of these technologies seem new, in some ways they're not that new. Or rather, you know, new technologies have constantly changed how we date. So, like, the automobile was a technology that really changed how people dated. So was the landline telephone. I say even a bar is a technology. You know, a bar can function like a social medium. It puts people together in a space. There are certain kinds of interactions you can have there. So anyway, I like to put the novelty of these sites in some historical perspective. That said, it definitely, there's a lot that is new about it, and the ways that you have to create a profile and create an online presence to be appealing to someone on these sites. I think, you know, it's hard to give blanket advice. I think if I could give blanket advice, I'd say it's always helpful to remember that these sites are really designed to keep you on the site. That's how they make money, is by keeping you on the site. And presumably most people's goal is to get off the site and meet someone in real life. So I think actually the returns on, like, obsessing over whether you should say your favorite show is The Wire or The Sopranos, or, you know, whether you like jam or pie better under your favorite food. They're sort of sharply diminishing returns on that kind of obsession. But besides, I don't blame anyone for feeling that way. You know, I was making fake profiles for my research, and I felt that way. It wasn't even real, so I totally get it. But I think that, you know, it's good to try to reflect a range of aspects about yourself and to be, you know, pick the right criteria to help you search for other people. But then my advice is to just try to get out and meet people in real life as fast as you can, because I think people can get sort of addicted to the sites and obsessive about them.
Maura, is it partially a result of people waiting? You remind us that the average age of marriage in this country is now 27, the highest it has been for women. Is this whole interest in and use of these sites an indication that people are working and they aren't in school anymore, and so the possibilities of meeting each other on campus or having a cup of coffee or being in the same class just aren't there, so you have to find a whole new way?
I think that that's right. I mean, I would say that it's very interesting, the data about the median age of marriage, because it's very class stratified, and more, you know, like so many things in America, courtship patterns are really splitting dramatically along class lines, and you see very different kinds of dating and marriage trajectories among folks with college educations or at higher income levels than among working class folks or people without a college degree. That said, I think that the proliferation of these apps is absolutely a reflection of the fact that people of all genders are prioritizing career, are working more hours in that upper bracket. What people are simply working a lot more hours every week than the 40-hour work week of, you know, of the mid-century. Because of cell phones and mobile technologies, I think work never really ends. And so there's a lot of pressure. You know, there's both just less time to meet people. I think the sort of quote-unquote traditional date that we think of people going out to dinner or the movies, that really came out of a time when work and leisure were very clearly divided, and, you know, after five was free time, and then you could schedule to do that. Now I think a lot of our schedules don't really work that way. So I think that this desire to create apps and sites, or to use apps and sites that let you sort of date on demand or work at it in whatever time you have available, are absolutely a reflection of this new work culture. And the fact, as you're suggesting, that women have more career options, you know, that everyone has more, basically has a wider range of personal ways they could order their personal life than they might have in, say, 1950.
Yeah. Let's go to Allison in Appleton. Hi, Allison.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It sounds wonderful, the things that, you know, you're talking about. There's a lot of laughing and a lot of good things going on, but there's also the ugly side to online dating and what to look for, you know, being careful to, you know, is this person who I'm speaking with the true person? It's kind of like that show MTV Catfish, as well as any dangers for women when they're looking for, like, an older man or something. How do we not know that if they're, you know, some sort of serial killer or something like that? So I was just wondering if you could share some general tips or some stuff just that we can look, you know, at and say, oh, this is kind of, you know, there's something fishy about this. So some general take care of yourself tips.
Yeah, and you cover the dark side of dating more in the book as well.
Yeah, it's funny. I think it's quite a lot of it. You know, we are laughing, but some of it is the bitter laughter of experience.
Right.
You're absolutely right that there are dangers associated with it. It's interesting. In the 1990s, when you first see these sites, you know, big sites like OkCupid and Match.com taking off, there's a lot of anxiety about the internet in the sense that we don't really know who someone is online. You can't be sure. I read a lot of advice books about online dating from that era that were saying, you know, never meet someone in person until he sends you a photograph and you talk on the phone. Today, I think in general, you know, it varies from platform to platform, but these apps are more integrated with our everyday sort of real lives. You know, almost all of the big dating apps pull their photos from Facebook. And will tell you, you know, if you have connections or friends in common. An app like Hinge is based on, I think Hinge is a good one to use, by the way, but is based on your social circle. So I think that there are ways that it's become a lot easier to sort of check the background of someone who you meet through a site or app. In a funny way, And also, I think there are two kinds of danger. I mean, one is the serial killer. The more likely danger is just that people treat one another badly, or, you know, sort of meet and then ghost one another or never show up again, that kind of thing. And so I think that the same rule that applies in general about not getting pulled into anything too deep on the app, but rather sort of meeting someone in a well-lit public place as soon as possible after you become interested or connect is a good rule of thumb for safety as well. That would be my advice, I think, on that topic.
And it certainly is an issue that's always been with us, be you doing online dating or you're living in a time of the AIDS crisis in this country, or you're worried about sexually transmitted diseases. I mean, that aspect of dating has been present for the whole century.
That's absolutely right. And it's really, I mean, I think another thing, and this is really dark, but I mean, women are susceptible to violence more than men are. Different classes, different races of women at different rates. But I was just reading about the Bachelorette show and how this character Chad on The Bachelorette is very violent or seems violent. And, you know, in many states, being hurt by your partner is like the number one way women are injured.
Right.
So I think that, you know, women can't live in fear, but this is a reality of male-female relations in general that's not unique, sadly, to the dating sites or dating apps.
We welcome more phone calls. Our guest this hour is Maura Weigel, and she is the author of Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating, which lists the whole history, more than a century of dating. We started dating in this country in about 1900, and she looks at many aspects of dating. Some of it remains remarkably the same, and there are some aspects more than a bit different. She's getting a PhD right now in comparative literature at Yale University. This is her first book, although she has done articles for a number of publications. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Join our conversation. You can talk about your dating experience, your particular history of dating and in what era it took place, what you see as changes in dating from 1900. Probably nobody is listening who was born in 1900 because you'd be pretty old. But you know what your grandparents or your great-grandparents said about how they met each other. Do we need a better way to find each other? What about the idea of just having family and friends be the ones who are looking out for you? People come to call instead of going to bars or going online to meet somebody for coffee or whatever. And the amount of money that we spend on all of this, it's remarkable. And if you happen to be a member of LGBT community, you find that it is a similar kind of procedure, but historically it's been a bit different, although there have been clubs where people of LGBT persuasion can be with each other and feel comfortable, and that's gone back, as the history shows in Maura's book, quite some time in this country. Well, at any rate, join us. 800-486-8655 is the number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'll never smile smile at you. I'll never laugh again. What good would it do for tears would fill my eyes?
Maura Weigel is our guest. The book we're talking about is Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating. As we were listening to music to put to this show, I was thinking they got it down in the 40s and 30s. Don't you think, Maura? I mean, they had the romance, the romantic songs at least.
They definitely had very good songs. I think it's a sad thing I've observed, particularly in the past year or so, that all of our pop songs are now about work. Like, none of them are about romance.
No.
I was joking. It's like Britney Spears went from singing I'm a Slave for You to You'd Better Work, Bitch. And then Rihanna, also her song this summer is Work, 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 Work. So I was like, I miss some, you know, just enjoying the romance rather than working so hard. They did have good songs.
Yeah, they did. Arthur is our next caller in Madison. Hi, Arthur.
Hey, thanks for having
Arthur.
Me.
Sure.
I was curious your take on this, or if there's been any research. I read an article about the impact of the rising rent prices on abusive relationships and how people are staying with abusive partners longer because they can't necessarily afford to move out. I was wondering how the rising rent prices has affected folks moving in together. If there's been, if people move in together earlier out of financial necessity than they otherwise would have.
I think that's absolutely right, and I'm so glad you asked that because I'm obsessed with the impact. And I just moved from New York to San Francisco, so I know a thing or two about rising rent.
I'll bet.
And I am obsessed with how rent and real estate affect the dating market. Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right that people, I don't have any hard data on this that comes to mind, but anecdotally, just having read hundreds if not thousands of advice columns and talked to dating experts from different papers, I think you're absolutely right that people are moving in together sooner, often in these expensive cities especially, because of practical considerations. You know, if you can stand to share a bed with someone, you can cut your rent in half, and that's a big deal in a lot of places in America. I'm also fascinated, sort of looking ahead, to how these things will change, how these trends in real estate are going to change how families are organized and how long-term relationships unfold. It might sound weird, but this whole idea that the way humans live or should live is in nuclear families is itself a pretty new idea. You know, until around 1800, most people in Europe and America lived on farms with extended family, and it's really only a product of urbanization and industrialization that gives us these single-family homes and the idea that, you know, you and your spouse and your kids are the center of a unit. Now what we're seeing, you know, from the Industrial Revolution to the Digital Revolution in San Francisco, where I am, is people living with roommates forever, you know, even people who are still in couples having roommates forever, some people, as you suggest, moving in really fast. So I think that these trends will really change how we think about our romantic relationships in particular, and then also just family structure and organization. We see people living with their parents longer in the millennial generation. If you have very strict parents, which I did, can certainly change your dating life. So I think it absolutely is playing a big role.
Mm-hmm. And money has historically, I was struck by the number of African-American women who at the turn of the century were involved as, they were working as well, but they were domestic servants, large numbers of them, which really changes your possibility for finding romantic love and being out on the town, right?
Absolutely. It's a big, it's a sad truth about American history that often African-American women have sort of the least appealing jobs. And around the turn of the century, that is often domestic service, which puts a woman, you know, in a home without the opportunity to meet people, usually not earning very much money, often tragically sort of prey to whatever your boss or boss's husband wants you to do, which can involve sort of sexual abuse. I read an interview, which I actually don't think I included in the book, but I read some interviews with working class African American women in the 1900s and teens who opted to go work on the railroads instead of working in domestic service. And there was this one interview where a woman talked about hauling hundreds of pounds of steel from, you know, sun up to sundown every day and said, oh, no, it's much easier than being a maid. I'd much rather do this. The pay is better. And then afterwards, I'm off. Because, you know, if you live in a home, you're never really off. So that's definitely, you know, that's definitely a pattern in the early dating history.
Arthur, thanks for your call. Kyle in Waukesha. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Well, surviving. I was kind of wondering what your guests thought about the MGTOW movement, the MGTOW, men going their own way and just refusing to date anymore.
You might have to, I know about men's rights. I don't know if I've heard about MGTOW. You might have to educate me a bit.
I don't know either, Kyle. What's it all about?
Basically, it's just a lot of guys who are sick and tired of being used by women and just refuse.
Used by women in what way, Kyle?
Financially, basically, you know, I mean, women move in with them and then they, start dating other guys while they're living with the first guy and, or else they're just out trying to get free meals or whatever they can get free from the guys. And, if you Google it, there's a large movement in this country.
And does getting out of it just mean not dating or having relationships?
Yep, exactly. You don't date women. You don't have relationships with women. You just, you're out of it.
Oh, but Kyle, there are good people out there. Good people out there, Kyle. That's pretty dismal what you described.
Very few. Very few.
Oh, Kyle. Maura, do you think that's true? There are very few good people?
I think there are all sorts of good people. I mean, I think it's true that romantic and sexual relationships often include this financial dimension, which can complicate them, you know, for men or for women. But hopefully, you know, we heard from a woman earlier who said she was just fed up with dating. It was too much work. She wanted out. And now we're hearing about men who want out. Hopefully, you know, since I think we do mostly, most people want some kind of intimate connection. Mm-hmm. There is a way to work past that impasse. But yeah, anyway, that's a new thing to me, the MGTOW.
Well,
I'll Google it.
Let's go back to 1900 for a moment, because there were women who were jailed for going on dates. Tell us that, about that story.
It's true. It's sort of one of the first things I learned about the history of dating, but still one of the most shocking, is that the first women who make dates with men are often arrested on prostitution charges. And it sounds crazy to us, but when you think back to the night, if you can, like, teleport in your mind to the early 1900s, before, women and men had always met through parents or through community if they were considering marriage. You didn't let strange men take you out and buy you things. The only precedent for that kind of behavior was sex work or prostitution. And so when the police saw young immigrant women letting men buy them dinner in exchange for romantic possibility, that's what it looked like. And I saw interview after interview with women from the Vice Squad or, you know, in a reform institution of some kind, saying, but I never took money from him. He just bought me dinner. I think one of the sweetest things I found in the archive was an interview like that, where the young woman who'd been arrested, her mother, who was Irish, actually came in and said, no, she only goes out with Joe Daly, and he doesn't give her cash or presents. They just go to the boardwalk in the movies.
Oh.
And so I actually don't know what happened to that woman, but I hope her mother won them over. So there's definitely, I think, this anxiety about who's in it for what is very deep, and unfortunately, I think, kind of impossible to get rid of. I think there is something inherently transactional about a lot of dating, and the truth is, it's hard to do away with. You know, it's hard to completely eliminate.
Right. Let's go to Joan, probably our last caller. Joan in Rolling Ground. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I'd like to tell you what turns out to be two stories about how my grandparents met in the early 19-teens in the Dakotas.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good.
She was a school teacher in a one-room school, and he was a cowboy, sheep herder, carpenter, whatever work he could get. And he was riding his horse home. A blizzard came in, and he saw a light on in the schoolhouse, and it was too late for there to be a light in the schoolhouse. So he went over. Turned out the blizzard had come in so fast, they were all marooned in the schoolhouse and couldn't get anywhere, had, you know, no water, no firewood. They weren't planning to spend the night in the schoolhouse. So he took the kids one by one over to the next farm and then took her, and by the time they were all done, they fell in love and got married.
Oh,
that's adorable.
It is.
Pro tip, if you want to.
That they had actually met earlier while she was still married to her first husband.
Hmm.
And the little baby girl heard him on the horse and ran out and got him to come in and rescue her. She was tied up. Her first husband had gone out and got drunk 3 days earlier and never came home.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my God. Well, good thing she got rid of that guy.
Yeah, you can say that again. So, Maura, did you meet online?
I didn't, and actually the story of meeting and then meeting again is a funny and apropos one, because I took a class with my husband in college. It was an introductory German class at 8:15 a.m. every morning, freshman year.
Oh, that's early.
We had a lot of conversations sort of along the lines of, like, would you like to go to the grocery store? What if, will we go to the discotheque? Like, what if we were to get a coffee? And we never really talked outside that. At that point, he was sort of a punk rocker. He wore all black. He had shaggy hair. I was like, this guy is cute, but he's bad. I'm not having anything to do with it. And then we flash forward 8 years, actually, and we re-met. I was dating someone who really was bad at that point, 8 years later, but never mind. And we met at a friend's engagement party. We had a I was dating someone else. The next week, I had a fellowship to go to China for 4 months to be at a university doing research there. And the couple whose engagement we were celebrating did not get married. They ended up breaking up, which was good because they were not happy together. But so it was sort of these extremely improbable series of events that led us to meet again. And yeah, when I got back from China, we went out, and it was kind of always nice after that. It wasn't too tumultuous, but I did something right in a previous life because otherwise I could still be with that crazy guy.
You
also probably would have tied me up.
You also did in writing the books. Thank you so much, Maura, for being with us.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
Yeah, it was fun. Maura Weigel, and the book is Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating. Thanks very much to KP Whaley, Scotty Myers, and Kira Salinas for producing and doing on-air production for this program. Thanks very much for listening and for all of your phone calls and stories. With you again on Monday, All Things Political First. Oh, baby, I love